This is Dave Green at Eastline Studio, where we produce the Historians Podcast. Bob Cudmore will have the latest edition of the Historians in just a few seconds. The Historians Podcast depends on your donations to continue. You may donate online at GoFundMe.com/thehistorians or send a check to Bob Cudmore, 125 Horseman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. The Historians is also heard on Rise, WMHT's radio service for the blind and print disabled, WMHT.org, and on SoundCloud search, Eastline Studio. And now, on with the show.
This is the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore. It's a pleasure to welcome best-selling author Bernard Cornwell. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you, Bob, and thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for joining us on the Historians Podcast. Bernard Cornwell has written his first book of nonfiction. Again, he's a well-known author of historical novels, but his first book of nonfiction called Waterloo, The History of 4 Days, 3 Armies, and 3 Battles. It's published by Harper. It's rolling out here in the United States, already a bestseller in the United Kingdom. Why did you turn to nonfiction, and why turn to this particular topic?
I think because Waterloo is such a compelling story. It's the most magnificent story. And for some strange reason, I've always wanted to write that book. I've always wanted to write the story of Waterloo. I don't have any wish to write any other nonfiction books whatsoever. People keep asking me, but it's not going to happen.
Okay. But you do have a fictional character who's well-known in a number of your novels, has been on television as well as a TV series, a character called Richard Sharp. And one of your books was about him was called Sharp's Waterloo. Did that kind of
prep? Indeed it was, yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's a rather different version of the battle to the one in the nonfiction book, I have to say. I mean, I think that Sharp's Waterloo is really written very much from a sort of British point of view, which is fair enough because Sharp was British. And there was a big tendency right through the 19th century and certainly went on into the 20th century to regard Waterloo as totally a British victory. In fact, of course, it was an Allied victory. There were far more Germans on the field than there were Brits, and of course an awful lot of Frenchmen as well. So although I like Sharp's Waterloo, it's definitely a book which is about how Sharp and the British Army saw the battle, not how perhaps history ought to see the battle.
Mm-hmm. And again, going back to your new nonfiction book, History of 4 Days, 3 Battles, 3 Armies, or I guess you had the other way, 3 Armies, 3 Battles, but what were the 3 Armies?
The 3 Armies are a British-Dutch army, that's under the Duke of Wellington, a Prussian army under Blücher, and of course Napoleon's French army. And Blücher and Wellington are allies, and they're in what is now Belgium. It wasn't called Belgium then, it was part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands. And France is under siege, of course. I mean, to very quickly set the scene, and I'm sure most of our listeners know all this anyway, so let's not bore them, but Napoleon had escaped from Elba. It's the famous 100 days. And the rest of Europe basically has declared war on him. And right at this moment, in the summer of 1815, 4 armies are converging on France. There's the British Dutch army, the Prussian army, the Austrians, and the Russians. And what Napoleon has to do is to defeat them one by one. And as the closest 2 armies are the Prussian and the British Dutch, he attacks northwards. So that is, is the scene. And if he succeeds in seeing off the British and the Prussians, then he'll still have to deal with the Austrians and the Russians.
Hmm. But you said that you didn't want to bore the people with the tale. But I would submit that we here in America, we're more removed from this than people over in Europe and England.
Well, yes, you are, though very strangely, an enormous number of towns came to be named Waterloo in the next 50 years just yeah. after the battle. And I think there is even in America, there was a sense that this had been an extraordinarily important engagement, that it basically decides the shape of the 19th century. I mean, that becomes really the British century, just like the 20th was America's. And I think there was a realization in America that with the Battle of Waterloo, the geopolitical shape of the world had changed. And that's one reason why so many towns came to be known as Waterloo. Of course, some of them were named because veterans of the battle moved there.
Mm.
And But yes, you're right, because America has no dog in the fight, but it does recognize that the fight affects the whole world. And basically what Waterloo is, it's a punctuation mark. It ends 50 years of history, and that those 50 years are dominated by the rivalry of Britain and France. And it began with what we call the Seven Years' War.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, was a great British victory because it hurled the French out of North America. But the result of that, really, is, of course, the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And people forget that the French took a very large part in that. In fact, the largest army at Yorktown was the French army. So they have a great victory in the American Revolution. But the problem is that it bankrupts them, and out of that bankruptcy comes the French Revolution, and out of that comes Napoleon. But with Waterloo, it all ends.
Mm.
Suddenly, whatever hopes France had of dominating the world vanish.
Yeah.
On that Sunday.
And another kind of American angle. I mean, Napoleon needs money for his many excursions and sells this large tract of land to President Jefferson.
Indeed, yes, Louisiana. I think it was a very good bargain for America.
It was. And I was fascinated in reading about Napoleon and the end of his career or his life. I mean, when it's finally over and he's lost it at Waterloo, he's trying to escape to America. That's where he wants to go.
He does. He orders a whole lot of books from the French library, the state library, to be sent to him all about the United States. And he does seem to have been quite serious about going there. And yet at the same time, he hesitates. I mean, he finally does move down to the coast. But by then, the British have blockaded it. I think if he'd moved, say, a week earlier, he might actually have made it. And then, well, that would have been interesting, wouldn't it? I mean, his brother Joseph settled in New Jersey. But it would have been interesting to have had the emperor as well.
Hmm. Well, Napoleon almost seems, to some extent, like a superhero. Maybe that's a stupid thing to say. But, I mean, he was beaten once, and they sent him to Elba. And then he comes back, and the army rallies around him.
They do. I think most of that is simply dissatisfaction with King Louis XVIII. I mean, Louis XVIII was a very bad monarch. And France was relieved when the Napoleonic Wars were over in 1814. I mean, France had suffered terribly. Far too many of their young men had died. And they had lost. And their country was invaded. Paris was occupied. And there was a sense of relief that it was all over. But then the new government simply proves to be inept, and the price of food goes up, and people, I mean, the economy goes to hell in a handbasket very fast. And people began to look back on the years of Napoleon as the years of glory. They forget the bad things and just remember the good things. And he was an extraordinarily clever man. He was a great administrator. He was supremely intelligent. He wasn't a vengeful man. I mean, you can't really call Napoleon a tyrant because he didn't exercise tyranny. In many ways, he was an enlightened ruler. If he had a fault, I think it's that he was in love with war.
Hmm.
And he really was in love with war. And he enjoyed war. His great hero was Alexander the Great. And of course, he was very, very good at it. Even his failures were gargantuan in scale. But I mean, he's an extraordinary man. And to follow him, obviously, was very difficult, and Louis XVIII failed utterly. So when Napoleon did come back from Elba, a lot of people rallied to him. Not everybody, but a lot of people did. And among the most important people to rally to him were, of course, his veterans, the soldiers, who had felt abandoned by the new government. They weren't getting their pensions. And suddenly there was the chance, once again, of employment, and if not of glory. So, yes, the army rallied to him very fast.
And it seems to me, and again, this is a distanced American's thought. You know, I've gone to Paris once and I saw Les Invalides, you know, which is the hospital he established, right, for the veterans, that he cared for his soldiers.
He did care for Les Invalides, in fact, was built by Louis XIV. But it was, I mean, like the Chelsea Hospital in London, a place for wounded soldiers. He was eventually, of course, to be buried there, not until the 1840s. I remember standing in the gallery overlooking his tomb, and an English lady said in a very haughty voice, "It looks just like the bathroom department at Harrods. There's an awful lot of marble there." He loved his soldiers, and his soldiers loved him, but he was incredibly careless with their lives. He He took huge casualties on the morning after the Battle of Austerlitz, which of course is one of his greatest victories. A French general was weeping, looking at the valley where there were so many French dead. And Napoleon said to him, you know, why are you crying? And the man said, look, sire, look at all those dead. And Napoleon looked at him witheringly and said, the women of Paris can replace them in one night. And when Talleyrand said to him, I think in 1814, during the negotiations for his first surrender, and said that it was pointless to go on fighting because he would lose a million men, Napoleon's answer was, what are a million men to me? And he does seem to have been one of those generals who was quite happy to take very large casualties in the cause of victory. And in this, he's the very opposite of the Duke of Wellington, who sheltered his men as far as he could. On the other hand, Napoleon's men adored him. They absolutely adored him.
Now, that's a point I believe you make in other interviews about the British Army at this time, that you get this impression that the British officers were a pretty haughty crew, and they compelled, I think the word was sullen obedience from their soldiers. But you've said that that was not really the case with Wellington.
It's simply not true. This seems to be a myth, that it was, you know, largely aristocratic officers who only enforced discipline by savage punishments and despised their men. In fact, all the letters, all the diaries, now I mean all of them, the memoirs, all say quite the opposite, that there's an extraordinary amount of affection between officers and men. And it showed again and again, and there are many examples at Waterloo. And the men were often very, very, most of the officers were not aristocrats at all. They tended to be quite a few of them in the Guards regiments. But most officers were what we would call middle class. I mean, a lot of clergymen's sons. And they were very proud of what their men did. They were very proud of the great string of victories in the Peninsular War. And there were two kinds of officers, one private soldier said. He said, there are the go-ons and the come-ons. And he said, luckily, we have very few of the go-ons. We just have the come-ons. And of course, the officers shared the same dangers as the men and shared the life. And this idea that somehow that there was a great gap between the two is simply wrong. And again, as I say, you get testimony from the ranks and from officers of just how much affection there was between them.
Best-selling novelist Bernard Cornwell with us. He has written his first, and he says it will be his only major work of nonfiction, Waterloo. What was fighting like in these days? I mean, this is 1815. Is it mainly infantry and cavalry fighting each other?
Well, there's really three arms. There's infantry, cavalry, and artillery, and it's scissors, paper, stone. And it's brutal. I mean, I'm sure all war is brutal. It always has been. But I suppose the significant thing about war in the 18th and early 19th century is the fact that the armies relied very heavily on the musket, and the musket is an incredibly crude instrument. It's not accurate at all. I mean, there's a letter in 1814 from one of the great experts who said that you could, if at 150 yards, you might as well shoot at the moon. You're just simply not going to hit anybody. So you had to mass your men. The men had to stand either in a thick line or a column or whatever it was to make the musket effective. What you couldn't gain in accuracy, you gained in sheer volume of fire. But if once you've massed men together in a big square or a big column, then they become terribly vulnerable to artillery fire. And artillery was especially for Napoleon. Napoleon loved his artillery. He was an artillery officer. He called his guns his beautiful daughters. And at the Battle of Ligny, which took place 2 days before Waterloo, where the Prussians drew up in full sight of the French, they suffered. Their ranks were simply torn to pieces by French artillery. Wellington was far cleverer than that. He hid his men on the reverse slope, which protected them from much of the artillery. And then, of course, you had the cavalry. Cavalry was very, very vulnerable to massed infantry fire. If you charged a square, you had really very, very little hope of breaking it. But if you managed to catch that infantry in an extended line, which was the other formation, then you were probably going to chew them to pieces, and that indeed happened at the Battle of Quatre Bras, which was, again, 2 days before Waterloo, where a British battalion was caught in line by French cavalry and lost its king's colour, and lost an awful lot of men as well. So But the nature of war, you're fighting at very, very close quarters. I mean, some of the officers and men after Waterloo said, we didn't really see the enemy. We just saw a bank of smoke, and we saw musket flashes lighting up that smoke, and we shot at the flashes. So one, you don't see very much because there's no smokeless powder. The battlefield is covered, absolutely covered in smoke. I mean, every time a cannon fires, and remember that there are something like 400 cannon in a very small space at Waterloo, just filling the air with thick, thick smoke, stinking of rotten egg smell. So you have smoke. You have the heat, because the blast of all these guns actually heated the air. One man said it felt like you were walking into an oven. And noise, I mean, incredible noise. The bands playing, the cannons firing, the crackle of muskets. An officer said, I shouted orders and the man next to me couldn't hear me. So it was very, very confusing. And I think even for most of these battles, most of the guys had no idea what had happened. At the end of the day, if you were in most battles in the Peninsular War, you really didn't have much idea of what had happened, whether you'd won or lost. They did at Waterloo because the eventual collapse of the French was so precipitous. But it's a very confusing, noisy, frightening, dangerous, horrible place.
Waterloo, the title of the book, The History of 4 Days, Three Armies and Three Battles. And you've talked about the first two battles and then the final battle at Waterloo. What happened there?
What happened at Waterloo? What happened at Waterloo really depends on what happened 2 days before. Remember that we talked, there were two armies in Belgium or in Holland. There were the British Dutch and the Prussians. And the campaign begins with this extraordinary success by Napoleon, who manages to split them apart. He attacks at the hinge, he defeats the Prussians, who retreat, he holds the British. The British are then forced to retreat. But the Prussians didn't retreat east towards Prussia, they retreated north. They're still within marching distance of Wellington's troops. And the key thing to understand about Waterloo is that Wellington would never have fought there unless he believed Blücher was marching to help him. And Blücher would never have marched to help him if he had not believed that Wellington would actually stand and fight. Mm-hmm. So for most of the day, the story is of Wellington defending a low ridge while waiting for Blücher to arrive on his left. And Blücher comes late. So the battle is longer and harder than Wellington had foreseen. But what he wanted the French to do was to attack him head on. And a very quick way to lose a battle was to attack the Duke of Wellington in a position he'd decided to defend. Remember, he had never lost a battle. There's no doubt that in 1815, everybody knew that the two greatest soldiers of the age, by a long, long way, were Napoleon and the Duke of Wellington, and they had never met in battle. This gives the battle an added piquancy, of course, that the two greatest soldiers of the age we're at last going to meet. So the day is spent with the French attacking the British head-on. And it was a very close-run thing, as the Duke said. It gets closer and closer. It goes right on into the evening. It was almost the longest day of the year in the middle of the summer. And it's not until 8:30, 9 o'clock at night that the battle is decided, by which time a second battle has started, which is the Prussian attack on the French right. So what happened? The French attack again and again, trying to break Wellington's line, and they fail. And finally they break, because they're now under pressure from the Prussians on their right, and because the British line simply has not broken.
And this is the end for Napoleon? Is he captured then? Or
it is the end for Napoleon, absolutely. He built castles in the air. Remember that the French are routed. They flee in panic, poor things. I mean, it had been a dreadful day for them, and they'd taken terrible casualties, and they fought extraordinarily bravely. But they suddenly broke in the evening, and there's this panicked rush southwards towards France again. And the Emperor is caught up in that. He has to jump out of his carriage, and the carriage is captured with all his jewelry and all his medals. But he gets across the border, and he writes to his brother in Paris, and he says, look, we'll gather up all the carriage horses in France to drag guns. We'll empty all the fortresses of their soldiers. He said, within a week, I can have 200,000 men. Well, he couldn't. Mm. I mean, it simply wasn't. I mean, the army had been completely broken. and he goes back to Paris. And Paris, the government in Paris just says, forget it.
Now, I've read that you were asked, well, did it really matter? I mean, if he wasn't going to lose at Waterloo, he would have lost anyway.
Yes, I mean, this point of view is often put forward, that, you know, that Waterloo can't be that important, because if Napoleon had won it, then he'd still have faced defeat at the hands of the Austrians and the Prussians. Well, we just don't know is the answer to that. I mean, if he pulled off the miracle of defeating the British, Dutch and Prussian army to the north, why wouldn't he do the same thing to the Austrians and the Russians, who he'd beaten many, many times before? I think it's a fairly specious point, and I think, you know, the real fact is that history did change. It turned on a dime at the Battle of Waterloo on June the 18th, 1815, and that gives the battle its importance in history.
And Napoleon, I believe you say, had a bad day, or did make mistakes that day.
He did have a bad day. And, you know, ever since, people have tried to explain it. I mean, some people blame it on sickness, although he himself never did. He never blamed his health for it. He certainly wasn't the same man he'd been, say, 20 years before. He was 46 years old now. He'd been a general for 23 of those years. He'd put on a lot of weight. But you know, people say, well, he was suffering from dreadful piles. And there's one story that he left the battlefield to have leeches applied to his piles, which seems to be a myth. He seems to be fatalistic. I mean, I think that's the conclusion I reached. He was certainly lackadaisical on the day of Waterloo. And although he had started the campaign, it's a very short campaign, it's only 4 days, he started it brilliantly. I mean, he caught the British and the Prussians totally by surprise. He pushes the Prussians back. He manages to his first ambition, which is to divide their armies. But then he somehow loses any sense of urgency. On the morning after the Battle of Ligny and Quatre Bras, when he should have been marching and should have been harassing Wellington, he spends the morning riding around the battlefield of Ligny as if sort of savoring his triumph there. And the same thing again at Waterloo. There comes a moment very late in the afternoon when Marshal Ney, who really ran the battle for Napoleon, at last succeeded in capturing one of the three great British fortresses, which was a farmhouse standing forward of the ridge. And Ney quite rightly sends for reinforcements and says, you know, if we attack now, we'll cut straight through them. And he's right. I mean, at that point, Wellington is incredibly vulnerable. And Napoleon, instead of sending reinforcements, he said, troops? Where do you think I'm going to find troops? Does he think I'll make them? Well, in fact, he had them. He'd got a reserve, which he could have put into the battle, and it was right there. But he decided not to. He decided to wait. And there is this sort of curious, I don't know, fatal, lackadaisical attitude on the day of the battle itself. And he was very fatalistic. He used to say that you don't really make plans for a battle. You simply engage the enemy and see what happens. So I don't know what the answer to that is. I don't think it's sickness. Because I think if he'd been sick, he would have admitted as much in his memoirs. It would have made a rather useful excuse for him. I think there's a sort of fatalism. He said long after the battle, he said, I always knew it would turn out that way, which of course he didn't. If he'd known that, he wouldn't have fought it in the first place. But it is a kind of fatalistic attitude.
I always like to follow things to the end, if you will. So he tries to flee to America, but the British put him in exile, but in a real different kind of place than Elba. He's
in St. Helena, yes. Yeah. Well, in which he was very, very fortunate, because all the other allies wanted to kill him. The Prussians especially were absolutely set on standing up against a wall and shooting him. And it was the British who said, no, you can't do that. It's simply an uncivilized thing to do. I mean, the man was an emperor after all. And the British insisted on saving his life, and he was never grateful to them, which is remarkable in some ways. And, of course, he was unhappy on St. Helena. But, I mean, in many ways, he's fortunate. They build him a house there. Okay, it's 21 rooms. I visited Longwood on St. Helena. It's not the greatest place, but nor is it a prison. He was guarded there by British troops, but they formed a cordon a long, long way from Longwood, so that Longwood itself was private, and he had his own servants and companions there. But the weather could be very unpleasant. It could be incredibly hot and humid there, and fogs for much of the year. He was very unhappy, and I mean, it's hardly surprising. I mean, this is a man who bestrode the world like a colossus, and suddenly he's pinned on this little tiny island in the middle of the Atlantic with nothing whatever to do. So, yeah, he was unhappy.
Hmm. Waterloo, the history of 4 days, three armies, and three battles, written by Bernard Cornwell. The book has done well in the United Kingdom, I believe, and it's just coming here.
It went to number one, and I think it was the best-selling history book of 2014, and it's just come out there in paperback, so I'm obviously very happy. It's actually just come out in paperback in France as well, but I don't know how well it's doing there.
See, you don't think it'll do too well in France, maybe?
I don't think it'll do quite as well in France, no.
Yeah. And again, I can't help but be struck as the English woman you described when I saw the Napoleon. I mean, people tell you about it, but Napoleon's tomb is really something.
In Les Invalides, yes, it is indeed. I mean, you know, it sums up in many ways perhaps the most salient point about Napoleon, which is la gloire, glory. I mean, that's what he gave to the French people. It's what they... I mean, there's a wonderful diary by a young student in Paris during the Waterloo campaign. And on the morning of the battle itself, and of course they don't know the battle is being fought, but the guns begin to fire from Les Invalides, and these are the guns that signal victory. And of course what they're actually celebrating is the victory at Ligny 2 days before. And this student says, it brought back all the memories of my childhood when the guns would fire after Austerlitz and Friedland and, you know, all the Jena, all the other great battles. So yes, the tomb at Les Invalides is absolutely a sort of a huge tribute to Napoleon. But I think what's even more interesting is that his original grave, the grave at St. Helena, is one of the most beautiful places in the world. It's up on a hanging valley, high above the sea, surrounded by blossom trees. It's a most beautiful place, and I can remember standing there thinking, I wouldn't mind spending eternity here. But the French wanted him back, and in the end, the British relented and allowed them to take him back.
Where is St. Helena?
St. Helena is way down in the South Atlantic. I mean, it's a little dot of an island. It's tiny. It's incredibly difficult to get to. They've just built their first airport. I think it's only just finished this year. And there may now be air service, but it's a very small airport, so you have to fly from, I think, Ascension Island. It's one of the most remote islands in the world. It was a British possession. It was a lot of sailing ships put in there on the way back from India. Mm. It's also totally inaccessible. When I went by boat, and if the weather's at all rough, you can't land because there's nowhere to land. I mean, there is a harbour, but the harbour is affected by north winds, and if there's too much wind and waves, it's simply too dangerous. So it's an extraordinarily remote place to be, but it was, I suppose, the perfect place to put someone like Napoleon, who'd already proved that he would escape from anywhere else.
Of course, you're well known for your character, Richard Sharp, even placed him at the Battle of Waterloo. As you're doing your research, do you think to yourself, my gosh, that's really Sharp? I mean, did you come across a real...
Well, you have to remember the Duke of Wellington rather disapproved of people like Sharp. There were a couple of officers who did very Sharp-like things and extraordinarily brave idiots. The Duke admired men who did their stolid duty. He liked order and duty and discipline. I admire the Duke very, very much, but he's not an attractive character like in the way that Napoleon is. I mean, if you and I were to have dinner with him, Bob, I mean, we'd find him pretty cold company. We'd find Napoleon very warm and engaging, I think. But the men who fought for the Duke had a huge admiration for him. One of them said, we know that we'll always be looked after, and he will always give us victory. What more could a soldier want?
Well, Bernard Cornwell, I'm sorry, we're just out of time. The book is nonfiction, Waterloo, the history of 4 days, three armies, three battles. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.